So this is going to be a talk about primordial non-Gaussianity and constraining the physics of inflation through deviations from Gaussian statistics in the initial conditions. First, I'm going to give an overview of inflation, a pedagogical overview for non-cosmologists at the level of Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics. And that'll motivate the search for non-Gaussian statistics in the CMB. Then I'll talk about data analysis in CMB and in large-scale structure. So to introduce inflation, inflation is largely motivated by the horizon problem, which can be stated as follows. When we look back to the early universe via the CMB, we see a nearly constant, nearly isothermal surface of less scattering. The difference between the hottest parts of the map and the coldest parts is they differ only in the fourth decimal place, which suggests that the whole thing was once in thermal equilibrium. However, according to the parts of the expansion history that we know about, the causal horizon at last scattering was much, much smaller, corresponding to an angular degree on the sky, which would mean that points separated by more than one degree have never been in causal contact. So to make this a little more quantitative, if we plot the quantity 1 over ah, which is the co-moving distance that light travels in an e-folding, we would integrate that to get the causal horizon. If we plot its evolution with scale factor a, in a log-log plot, the slope is 1 plus 3w over 2, where w, the equation of state parameter w is defined to be the mean pressure of the universe divided by its energy density. So in a universe filled with the types of matter that we know about, either non-relativistic matter, dust, or relativistic matter like photons, W is positive, the slope is positive, and if we integrate, we'll always get a small causal horizon at early times. This way of presenting the horizon problem suggests that we can solve it by preceding the usual expansion history by some component where W is sufficiently negative, the magic number is minus one-third, so that we get a decreasing function in the plot, and if we integrate back, we'll get a large causal horizon, bring our whole observed universe today into causal contact. So we need a source of negative pressure in the universe, and one candidate is to have a scalar field rolling down a potential. So this is some source of energy V that can shut off. It's dynamical. It's controlled by a scalar field. It's just a potential. So the way this works is that the stress energy tensor for a minimally coupled scalar field like this has a term which depends on derivatives of phi, a kinetic term. That behaves as a component with W equals plus 1. And the potential energy behaves as a component with W equals minus 1, so that if the expansion is potential dominated, corresponding to a slow descent of the inflaton down this potential, W will be close to minus 1. We will get inflation and solve the horizon problem. So the horizon problem is one way to motivate inflation, but what's amazing about it is that it does double duty. In addition to solving the horizon problem, it naturally generates perturbations in initial conditions with our universe with the correct statistical properties. So because this calculation is just uses Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics, and because it's so pretty, and because it can be explained in a slide and a half, I couldn't resist putting it into the introductory part of the talk. So it's a prediction of quantum mechanics in an inflationary background that microscopic degrees of freedom get quantum mechanically excited. So to show how this works, let me just consider a simple example. This is a massless test scalar field, and the test scalar meaning it doesn't back react on the metric. I'm going to take the limit of very slow roll, the de Sitter limit, where the Hubble constant during inflation is roughly constant. And so the action for this field would take this form with time dependence in the action given by the so-called minimal coupling that gives you an a squared. This action is quadratic, so each Fourier mode, each K mode of the field, behaves as an independent degree of freedom with a time-dependent Hamiltonian shown here. And just to make this look like Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics, I've used XP notation. So X just stands for one Fourier mode of the field, and P stands for its conjugate momentum. So if we take that Hamiltonian and just do Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics, the Schrodinger equation for this Hamiltonian, so this is a harmonic oscillator with time-dependent mass and spring constant. The Schrodinger equation is exactly solvable. If you work hard enough, you can arrive at this wave function, which just looks like a time-dependent constant and phase times a Gaussian wave function whose width is changing with time. In the early time limit, early in inflation, this wave function approximately tracks the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. This is the adiabatic limit, where the time dependence of the Hamiltonian is slow compared to the period of the oscillator, and the system can evolve in a way which keeps up with the ground state. In the late time limit, we have the opposite scenario, where the time dependence of the Hamiltonian is fast. The wave function can't keep up, so to speak, and so it's just frozen at a constant coordinate wave function. What this shows is reverting, changing from the x notation back to sigma k, at the end of inflation, each k mode of the scalar field is in an excited state, a state with large occupation number. We can think of it as a Gaussian random quantity. This is happening independently for each Fourier mode of the field, and that is what we call a Gaussian field. We have a Gaussian field with some k-dependent variance that we can read off from the width of this the width of this Gaussian. The power spectrum that we get is proportional to 1 over k cubed, a scale invariant power spectrum, which is roughly what we need to get the right initial conditions for our universe. So the same mechanism, I illustrated it for the test scalar, but the same mechanism applies to other degrees of freedom. To convert degrees of freedom which dominate the energy during inflation, the inflationary sector, to convert those to the fluctuations in Saturn model particles that we need to start our universe, we need to assume something about that conversion. So the simplest thing to assume would just be to assume that inflaton perturbations decay to standard model perturbations in a way which conserves energy and which generates a so-called adiabatic perturbation. So adiabatic means that the metric can be put in this particular form. The function zeta is what I'll use throughout the talk to parameterize initial conditions. This is the what's called the adiabatic curvature. And that within this background metric, all species are in thermal equilibrium. So I've now specified a complete inflationary model, single field slow roll inflation with standard reheating. Our previous calculation showing that we can expect Gaussian perturbations, if you include interactions that come from expanding the potential in a Taylor series, you will find that the deviations from Gaussian statistics generated by those terms are unobservably small. This was first calculated in full detail in this seminal paper by Maldacena. This calculation has assumed a few things. It's assumed that inflation is single field, that the inflaton Lagrangian takes the simple form with minimal coupling, and that reheating is homogeneous, happens the same everywhere. So in the next part of the talk, I'll motivate deviations from those assumptions and explain how they tie into deviations from Gaussian statistics.
Can you explain what you mean by homogeneous?
The simplest let me give an example of how reheating could not be homogeneous. So if we assume that reheating doesn't happen the same way everywhere, but that the decay rate is different, and that difference is controlled by a scalar field. So to be general, let's write the decay rate at a point x as some local nonlinear function of some field sigma. And now let's assume that sigma acquires perturbations during inflation by the standard quantum mechanical mechanism. So this variation in the decay rate on its own will generate an adiabatic curvature fluctuation. In other words, even if there was no curvature fluctuation from quantum mechanically excited, this mechanism would generate one out of sigma, fluctuations in sigma. Intuitively, what happens is that if a region decays late, it gets to expand more, and that is what we mean by an adiabatic curvature perturbation. We get a perturbation to the space space as part of the metric. So if we vary the decay rate, we get an adiabatic curvature perturbation, which in general is a nonlinear function of gamma, but we can plug one nonlinear Taylor series into another and say that in this modulated reheating scenario, we get an adiabatic curvature perturbation, which is just some nonlinear function of a Gaussian field. Now, it's conventional to change notation here and call the quantity A delta sigma, call that zeta G, that's some sort of Gaussian leading term in zeta, and then you'll get additional terms here with model-dependent coefficients, and there's a factor of 3/5 here, which is just introduced to make life confusing. So this is one This is one non-Gaussian model where the initial curvature perturbation is a nonlinear function of a Gaussian field. In general, there would be cubic and higher terms, so let me just assume that they're negligible. This model is more general than the modulated reheating scenario that I described to obtain it. It's generated in a number of physical contexts that all involve multiple fields in some way. So there could be a field that modulates the decay rate. There could be the so-called curviton scenario, where you have a spectator field during inflation that ends up sourcing the curvature perturbation. There are ekphorotic scenarios, where the surrounding physical context is very different from inflation, where you have a cold contracting universe instead of a hot inflating one. The surrounding physics is very different, but it's similar to the curviton model in that a second field sources zeta. So in these models, I'm going to claim that if you don't do any fine tuning of parameters, you tend to get an FNL parameter, as defined here, which is, say, of order 10. I wrote 1 to 100 on the slide, since this is relatively model dependent. The observational errors, so let me say that the normalization here is such that FNL of order 1 corresponds to initial conditions which are Gaussian to roughly 1 part in 10 to the 5. So we're talking about really tiny levels of non-Gaussianity, but nevertheless, the observational constraints are approaching the interesting range. So this is kind of a generic signature of multi-field inflation, and there's a theorem that says that you cannot get this type of non-Gaussianity in single-field models. Another way to get non-Gaussian statistics is to introduce some interactions during inflation. Our calculation of Gaussian statistics was equivalent to saying that the QFT of the inflaton during inflation was a free theory. So if you add interactions, for example, let me consider an interaction which is proportional to sigma dot cubed. I'll motivate this funny looking choice of interaction in a minute. Then you'll generate higher cumulants of the distribution. So the way that you would calculate this is just using perturbative QFT. We can solve the free theory exactly. We can expand in powers of the interaction. And if the coupling constant is small here, then the deviation from Gaussian statistics, the only term that is first order in F is the three-point function, which can be calculated just, there's just a single diagram that contributes. If you calculate this diagram, you get some relatively tame integral that you can evaluate. So this is the three-point function that we're... Yeah, that's right. So I just chose an arbitrary operator just for illustration purposes. I'll generalize this in a bit. No, this is just for introduction. We have a statement that we stated as a classification theorem, which says that, so the example that I showed was just for a test scalar. And it may not be obvious that a test scalar would cover all the possibilities for an interacting field during inflation. But nevertheless, it can be proved under certain assumptions that the most general curvature three-point function you can get at the end of inflation is just the sum of two terms corresponding to the three-point function of a test scalar with a sigma dot cubed interaction and a test scalar with an interaction which is one derivative of sigma times two spatial derivatives. So this is the tool used to prove this is effective field theory. In effective field theory language, you just want to consider the operators with the fewest derivatives, which are consistent with the relevant symmetries, which in this case are a shift symmetry that protects inflation from ending too early. So that's intuitively why we end up with we have operators that contain derivatives. So this statement has loopholes. It requires, first off, this is only for single field inflation, where you can use effective field theory to just change to the Goldstone boson associated with time translations. It assumes single field that the inflaton is the source of the curvature perturbations. There's a fine-tuning assumption here, which is that you don't get some combination of higher derivative terms that would be finely tuned in order to get to guarantee radiative stability against these lower derivative terms. This assumption might need to be rethought, but let me just make it for now. And finally, this statement doesn't cover cases where the time translation invariance is broken, if there's some explicit time dependence like an oscillatory potential or a phase transition during inflation, some transient behavior, something that ruins the time translation symmetry. So this is motivation for looking for these particular three-point functions, the three-point functions generated by these operators at the end of inflation. Now I'm going to show some plots. We've identified three signals, the two single field operators and the local model. And we're going to constrain these via the three-point function of the curvature. So this three-point correlation function, by translation invariance, requires that the vector sum of the k's is zero. Rotation invariance means that it only depends on the shape of the triangle, not its overall orientation. So let's just plot this quantity as a function of the ratios of the side lengths, plot this three-point function. Just to be pedantic, I've inserted, when I plot versus the side ratios on the edges of the plot, I've inserted these this factor of k2 squared, k3 squared. That's a phase space volume factor, which just means the regions that are large in the plot visually correspond to regions of large signal to noise. So for the local model with a zeta squared term in the initial conditions, you can calculate the three-point function. And if you plot it, you find that the signal to noise peaks on triangles where one of the side ratios is close to one, the other is close to zero. That corresponds to these so-called squeeze triangles, which represent a correlation between a long wavelength mode of the curvature and small scale power. The single field shapes, generated by sigma dot cubed, or this other operator, if you plot them individually, they look similar to each other. And so it's convenient for the data analysis to orthogonalize. So this is the basis that we're going to use to analyze the data. We can just consider a linear combination of these guys, which is roughly orthogonal to either of the shapes individually. And in this way, we end up with an equilateral shape, which is a bit more generic. This peaks on in the case where side ratios are one, equilateral triangles, and an orthogonal shape, which changes sign between equilateral triangles and so-called flattened triangles, where the sum of the side ratios is one, corresponding to a flattened triangle. You'll notice in this plot, by the way, that both of these shapes go to zero in the squeeze limit. That always happens in single field inflation by a theorem of Crominelli and Zaldarriaga, and is the reason why single field inflation cannot generate local FNL. So I introduced three signals that we want to look for in data. In the next part of the talk, I will talk about CMB data analysis. The next few slides will be rather technical and will be mainly statistical and computational, but I just want to give a flavor for what we actually do when we analyze the data. Conceptually, what we're trying to do is the following. We have some sort of interaction during inflation. Say we're interested in a pi dot cubed interaction. We can calculate at the end of inflation what three-point function we expect to see in the 3D field that defines the initial conditions. And then we have to evolve that to the three-point function of the CMB. Since the CMB is linear in zeta, this is a linear operation. Then we have the three-point function of what we actually measure. And we want to write down an estimator for its amplitude, for its coefficient. And then we'd like to just plug in the WMAP maps and get a constraint.
You could also look at four-point functions and so on. Is that just
hopeless? The four-point function is something that we're working on now that I will talk about. I'll talk about a little. So the first thing that happens is that if you try to be too general, then things become computational. Oh, yes, sorry.
So these results you were mentioning about the four-point function, was that relying on getting just one input I'm just wondering if you get a large number of theories together somehow regulation, can you really constrain some of the four-point function?
So in multi-field inflation, there are more possibilities. The operators that you can include in the Lagrangian and still be consistent with symmetries don't have to have derivatives everywhere. That's right. I would argue for multi-field inflation, you tend to get the local shape, and for single-field inflation, you get equilateral and orthogonal non-Gaussian. So if you try to be too general, then things are computationally intractable. Just computing the three-point function of the CMB, given the three-point function of the initial curvature, involves these horrible oscillatory integrals, which are very slow to compute. One little comment here is that I'm just treating the CMB as some sort of linear black box where you pre-compute this so-called transfer function. This contains all sorts of interesting physics, the acoustic physics that sets the peaks and so on, but I'm not going to talk about it. I'm just going to treat the CMB as some sort of linear gadget that generates an observable three-point function out of a primordial one. So this, even this 3D to 2D projection is too slow. There's an optimal estimator that you can write down as a sum over triples of modes in the map. Its computational cost would be on the order of CPU years for WMAP, which is too slow, especially since we want to put it inside a Monte Carlo loop. So there's an interesting phenomenon, which is that if you take the general formulas are intractable, but if you take a physical shape, meaning that it comes from a Feynman diagram, yes?
So usually if there's a spherical vessel function that multiplied by a Scully-Varian function, we can use something similar to Lipper approximation to do the integrals. I wonder whether that could be done here.
It would be my guess that if all the L's are large, then the Limber approximation would be reasonably accurate. To my knowledge, that's never been tried for the three-point function, but I would guess that it would work. I mean, I'm going to describe a different approach that also works. So consider the three-point function that you get from this diagram with a pi dot cubed interaction during inflation. This is naturally, the Feynman diagram is naturally represented as an integral over conformal time. And if I decide not to do that integral and just feed this through the general formulas on the preceding slide, then a sequence of algebraic miracles occur such that the estimator is computationally tractable. You just take the data here, this ALM object, filter it in Fourier space by some pre-computed function involving CMB transfer functions, cube it, and then there's some integrals on the outside which are just sums, and this is computationally not too bad. It turns out that this miracle is general, and can be understood as just arising from the combinatorics of the diagram. You can think of this even as a set of Feynman rules that let you skip this calculation altogether and go straight from the diagram to an estimator. So we can write down a set of estimator Feynman rules where each vertex of the diagram corresponds to a pair of integrals in the estimator. Each edge in the diagram corresponds to some pre-computed function involving CME transfer functions. And each external line connects to a copy of the data, so to speak. Like there are three powers of the data here. So this generalization makes it clear how to do, for example, four-point estimators. You could imagine a four-point function that comes either from a quartic interaction during inflation or by combining two three-point cubic interactions with an exchange. And we can automatically do these cases. So there's a large literature on computational strategies for estimating endpoint correlation functions in the CMB. And our perspective is that if you're doing something inflationary, you can just sidestep all of that, go back to the physics. It will more or less give you a prescription for computing things efficiently. A little computational problem. This is more of an inconvenience than a showstopper, but a computational inconvenience is that the estimator that was obtained has two outer integrals. In practice, we want to replace those by discrete sums. Naively, you need many terms to do these integrals. We propose a general optimization algorithm, which is very effective at reducing the number of terms in the sum. So the general way to describe the algorithm is as follows. Suppose that you have some statistical estimator, which is a sum of many pieces. And you know the covariance matrix, or have some reasonable approximation to the n by n covariance matrix between the pieces. The optimization algorithm, via some linear algebra tricks, will find a minimal subset of terms with weights such that a linear combination of the subset accurately approximates the original estimator in a sense defined by the covariance matrix. So that's an approximation which is accurate in the sense of observational distinguishability. That's the general form. And when we apply it to this FNL estimator, the terms in the estimator correspond to sampling points for a double integral. The optimization algorithm is just automatically generating a more efficient sampling. And
what is
N? You put N. So I guess M is the size of the subset. So M, hopefully.
How is that determined?
So the optimization algorithm is exploiting correlations. So if you randomly generated if these estimators were uncorrelated, then it would not succeed in optimizing anything. But in practice, there's not too many independent shapes that are summing up to give this three-point function.
So
yeah.
You need a certain value n to achieve a certain level of accuracy.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a controlled approximation where you specify a tolerance first, and then it terminates when it's sufficiently accurate. So for this estimator, for a pi dot cubed estimator, our strategy is just to massively oversample the tau r plane. We start with something like 80,000 terms. The optimization algorithm just runs and does its magic and gets the number of terms down to 86 in this case, which can be done, even for Planck, can be done in a few CPU hours. One more ingredient, monster called C inverse. So various types of optimal estimators call for filtering each mode of the CMB map by its total inverse variance. So the matrix S here is the signal covariance, which is diagonal in harmonic space. The matrix N is the noise covariance, which in WMAP is diagonal to a good approximation in pixel space. There's no convenient basis where they're simultaneously diagonal, it's computationally expensive to do this inversion. It appears to be involve way too large of a matrix to invert. So we have a fast multi-grid algorithm, which is a black box where you feed in a vector, in this case a map. The components of the vector correspond to pixels in the map. And it outputs a map, which has been filtered by the C inverse filter.
Do matrices have the same order of magnitude?
What do you mean by order of magnitude?
So element by element, are they? One way of trying to do it is to do a perturbation expansion of one of them.
Right. So you should think of on large angular scales, the signal covariance is going to dominate, and on for modes with short wavelength, the noise is going to dominate. So we have a fast algorithm for solving this problem, which I'm not going to say much about except to say that it's recursive. It's based on approximately solving the inversion problem on a lower dimensional map and using that to improve the solution at a higher resolution. And it does this, and after many recursive iterations, it's accurately converged to the true solution. So this is very powerful because it enables all sorts of optimal statistics. All sorts of optimal estimators call for this type of filtering. For example, the optimal power spectrum estimator is something that has never been implemented in WMAP, but as part of the WMAP9 analysis, I'm implementing optimal power spectrum estimation, which will shrink the error bars by something like 10 or 20% relative to previous releases. So that's sort of an overview of the sort of dirty computational details that we become embroiled in before we can get to the fun stuff, which is WMAP results.
So, can I ask a question? So has this been implemented for Mac and SVT, things like that?
No. I'm not involved in either of those. But as far as I know, they don't have plans to implement those. First, I'll talk about constraints on the local FNL. In 2009, we published the first optimal constraints on FNL local. We got a result that was consistent with zero at just shy of 2 sigma. The context here is that at the time that we did this, there were a variety of results in the literature that attracted a lot of interest and ambiguity. In chronological order, there was a 1 sigma result, a 3 sigma result, and a 2 sigma result. So it wasn't clear which of those you should prefer. So our perspective is that none of these results there was nothing wrong with any of these results. They were all just significantly suboptimal because they were making different approximations to the optimal estimator. And in a situation where you're optimally 2 sigma, and the result depends significantly on arbitrary choices, it's possible to make arbitrary choices in a way which gives you 1 sigma, 2 sigma, or 3 sigma. So the optimal estimator is valuable for two reasons. First, it achieves the smallest possible error bars. Secondly, it disambiguates the analysis by removing the dependence on arbitrary choices. It just gives everyone a way to agree on a unique result. If two people implement the optimal estimator and get different answers, then someone is doing something wrong. Current WMAP data appears to be consistent with single field inflation.
Can I ask just to make sure I understand? When you say optimal estimator, that's relative to a particular model of what's causing the.
Optimal in this case means minimum variance if you imagine an ensemble of Monte Carlos with Gaussian initial conditions.
But what you're estimating is FNL. Didn't you get that out of a particular model? Does that have a meaning independent of, does that have a model-free meaning?
A model-free meaning. We think of it as a constraint in this particular model, in the local model. I could imagine a situation where you have some other three-point function which is just correlated to this but not precisely equal, and then you would pick it up, multiply by some cross-correlation coefficient in this analysis. Is that what you're asking? That's right. That's right. The estimator. The estimator builds that in. It weights each triple of modes by its expected three-point signal. So we need a template to do that weighting.
But if someone had a different theory of what Gaussian, then this might not be an optimal estimator for that other.
Absolutely not. That's right. I mean, that makes this whole thing kind of multifaceted. You have different signals that you're interested in and estimate them.
It's a lot of different goals, yes.
That's right. Yeah, there's only one definition for Gaussian, but many definitions for non-Gaussian.
But in principle, there could be some parameters.
That's right. I mean, I think you want to rank things somehow by theoretical plausibility. If you search for too many things, then you'll dilute your statistical significance if there's something there. So our approach has been to sort of find as many shapes as we can that are physically motivated and estimate them independently. Those are optimal constraints on the local FNL. For the single field shapes that I discussed, the equilateral and orthogonal FNLs, we published the first optimal constraints here in 2009. By the way, this has all been incorporated into the WMAP pipeline. I mean, I joined the WMAP team, and this has been incorporated into the WMAP pipelines. If you want to join a large experiment, a good way to do it is to keep publishing results with smaller error bars in the collaboration. After a while, people will get annoyed enough that they'll invite you to join. So at the time we published this result, this was the first optimal analysis. Interestingly, these were not the smallest error bars that one could find in the literature. So this analysis is very numerically difficult. There are a lot of near cancellations that happen in the estimator, and you have to make sure that you've really controlled all your approximations to avoid a situation where things don't completely cancel out. You just get some spurious numerical noise which acts as a fake signal. This is the allowed two sigma region in the FNL equilateral, FNL orthogonal plane. And because this is the most general form, we think, the most general three-point function that you can get in single field inflation, this functions as a kind of master result that you can compare to any single field model that you're interested in. So just as one example, DBI inflation is an interesting string-motivated model of inflation, where what we call the inflaton at a point in space-time is really the distance between two brains in a compactification. The low-energy effective action has this dBi square root in it. The physics of this is kind of interesting. The requirement that the square root can never, that the argument to the square root can never go negative, sets a speed limit on how fast the inflaton can move down the potential. Which is just related to the fact that the inflaton is really the position of something, and there's a causal speed limit of how fast that can move. In this model, the inflationary potential is not flat. It's a steep potential, but inflation nevertheless can act for, can last for many e-foldings due to the speed limit being built in for how quickly the inflaton can roll down. So the real motivation in the low energy effective theory, inflation, the existence of many e-foldings of inflation is related to the existence of large self-interactions of the inflaton, which slow it down. So this type of model is one good motivation for searching for self-interactions of the inflaton, the operators that I had mentioned earlier. There's this physical idea that it may be self-interactions of the inflaton, not flatness of the potential that enable inflation. Okay.
Does this give sigma dot to the fourth?
Yes, I suppose that it would. I haven't done this calculation, so that would, I
you mean because if you extend the square?
Yeah. I think that must be order f and l squared, so that if the non-Gaussianity is small, you see the three-point function first. But I never personally checked that. Okay. So non-Gaussianity in this model, like all single field models, you just get the equilateral and orthogonal F and Ls. Non-Gaussianity depends on one parameter, a sound speed CS. An interesting thing in this model, so the WMAP constraints give you a lower bound on CS. An interesting thing in this model is that the tensor mode signal is proportional to one power of CS, so that you can get you have to get either non-Gaussianity or gravity waves. In WMAP, there's a range of CSs which are compatible with both constraints, both the non-Gaussianity and tensor mode constraints. But in Planck, if Planck observes neither non-Gaussianity nor tensor modes, then we'll rule out the entire parameter space and show that this is not the theory of inflation in our universe. One more set of results, which I snuck in because I think this topic is fun. But which are not primordial non-Gaussianity. So previously, I've been talking about non-Gaussianity, which is may or may not be present and is primordial. I'm going to talk about a type of non-Gaussianity which is a guaranteed signal and comes from low redshift due to gravitational lensing in the CMB. So gravitational lensing deflects geodesics back to the last scattering surface, and this just moves hot and cold spots around without generating new ones. If you pretend for a minute that you could observe a 2D field, rho, which is the projected matter density. So that's defined, that's a 2D field defined by just integrating the matter fluctuations in our universe along a line of sight. If you pretend for a moment that you can observe rho, then gravitational lensing would generate a three-point function involving one power of rho and two powers of the CMB temperature in this so-called squeeze configuration with a long wavelength rho mode and two small-scale temperature modes. So this three-point function appears easily enough when you do the math, but I want to interpret it intuitively just to give you a sense for why you should expect this. So here's sort of an intuitive picture. So consider a large region of sky, say 10 degrees, which is over-dense relative to the mean. If we look through this region of sky, an over-dense region will cause geodesics to converge. That means that the CMB will appear slightly magnified. Hot and cold spots will be larger, and the acoustic peaks will shift to lower L, as shown by the blue curve. Likewise, if we look through an underdense region, then we measure the local power spectrum looking through a large-scale underdensity, then we'll see the red curve with the acoustic peaks shifted to higher L. So we have a kind of correlation between the locally observed power spectrum and the large-scale lenses. Because the locally observed power spectrum is a two-point quantity, we're talking about a three-point correlation involving one power of rho and two powers of t. There are two scales. There's the angular scale of the lenses, which is a large scale, and there's the angular scale of the hot and cold spots that we are indirectly, which are lensed, and these that is the two small scales. This is not a primordial signal, but it's a three-point function. And we can use our estimator technology to look for any three-point function. So we tried looking for this. We can't actually observe rho directly, but what we can do is use a cross-correlation tracer. So if we take radio galaxy counts from NVSS, take their positions on the sky, And use those galaxy counts as a tracer for the projected matter density, we can look for the NVSS WMAP WMAP 3-point function. And when we did this, we found it at 3.5 sigma. At the time, this was the first detection of CMB lensing. This will soon be, so this was a milestone for the field. This will soon be a source of precision cosmology. For example, in Planck, we should see this at 30 sigma. We'll have a 3% measurement, and we can start getting constraints on cosmological parameters. This was sort of the first step, just getting the first detection. The optimal estimator, by the way, was critical in getting this statistically significant result. Okay. In the last 10 minutes, I'm going to talk about a new observational frontier, which is large-scale structure. So I want to talk about clustering of bound objects, say dark matter halos, in Gaussian and non-Gaussian cosmologies. So in a Gaussian cosmology, on large scales, things are simple to model. The fractional overdensity of halos in a big box, a big subregion of the universe, is just some order one constant called the halo bias times the fractional overdensity of matter in the same region. So if I were to compute, say, the matter-halo power spectrum, that would just be B times the matter-matter power spectrum. And the halo-halo power spectrum would just be B squared times the matter-matter power spectrum. These three curves are just proportional to each other. You should think, by the way, of all three of these curves as something that we can observe and measure with high accuracy. The halo-halo power spectrum is what we measure when we count galaxies and take their angular power spectrum. Galaxies live in halos, so they're just tracing the halo-halo power spectrum with some modeling details related to how halos of a given mass host galaxies. The matter-matter power spectrum we can measure via gravitational lensing through lensing measurements that use mean galaxy ellipticity. The matter-halo power spectrum we could measure, say, by cross-correlating lensing maps and galaxy counts. This type of observation is sometimes called galaxy-galaxy lensing. Okay, so on large enough scales, halo clustering in a Gaussian cosmology just follows this simple picture. Now, in an FNL cosmology, for this part of the talk, FNL means FNL local, by the way. In an FNL cosmology, the following interesting thing happens. Let me just show you what happens, and then I'll interpret it intuitively. So the bias factor that relates halos and matter at wave number k becomes k-dependent. The bias at scale k is the usual constant piece, plus a term proportional to FNL over k squared. The constant B1 is of order 1, so that order unity FNL corresponds to an order unity contribution to the bias at wavelengths comparable to the Hubble scale. With this k-dependent bias, the matter-halo and halo-halo power spectra are just, at scale k, are just B and B squared times the matter-matter power spectra. And so when you go to large enough scales, the k squared wins, and you see this big signal kick again. This is potentially a great constrainer on FNL. For example, once we get the FNL measurement from Planck, then it will be hard to improve further using the CMB, but large-scale structure experiments, for example, LSST, can go quite a bit farther. Before generalizing this result, I want to just interpret it intuitively a little bit. So you might think that if we're talking about measuring non-Gaussianity at the level of 1 part in 10 to the 5 in large-scale structure where non-linearities are of order 1, that we're just talking about something crazy. And that would indeed be true if we had to use the small-scale modes. The fact that the signal is kicking in on the largest scales means that it's very difficult for gravitational physics to mimic it. If there's some sort of gravitational effect, like say, second-order perturbation theory, then because of general constraints, like just conservation of mass and conservation of momentum, you cannot generate this 1 over k squared. There are subtle things that can, like deviations from the GR corrections to the Newtonian approximation, but those can be calculated and subtracted. So this observational signature is maximally protected from astrophysical effects. It is, however, quite instrumentally difficult to measure. Okay, so here's an intuitive picture of an FNL cosmology. If I have a long wavelength mode, then if the cosmology were Gaussian, then the small scale modes that ride along on top of it would be statistically independent. In an FNL cosmology, the amplitude, the local power spectrum amplitude in a positive fluctuation is different from the local power spectrum amplitude in a negative fluctuation. This is just another way, a pictorial way of saying that the three-point function is large in squeezed triangles. The local power spectrum on scale Ks, on small scale Ks, is correlated to a long wavelength fluctuation on large scale KL. This particular form of the three-point function with the cubes is equivalent to the statement that the locally measured power spectrum amplitude in a subregion of the universe. So when I do work on large-scale structure, I'm hardwired to call the amplitude of the primordial power spectrum sigma 8. A local observer who measures that amplitude will see a value which is equal to some mean value plus a term proportional to FNL phi, where phi is the Newtonian potential. So the Newtonian potential is modulating the local sigma 8. Okay. So this picture naturally leads to enhanced large-scale clustering. If I consider local observers living here and here, then they will see two things different. They'll see their local matter density different, just due to the long wavelength mode. This is a long wavelength mode of the matter density. And they'll also see their local sigma 8s different. The locally observed halo density depends on both those quantities. So we can imagine linearizing the dependence and writing the locally observed halo density as some constant B0 times the local matter over density, plus some constant B1 or B1 over 2 times the locally observed sigma 8. Substituting FNL phi for the sigma 8 fluctuation, and then using Poisson's equation to trade phi for a matter fluctuation divided by k squared, we get the FNL over k squared clustering shown on the previous slide. So that's an intuitive picture for what's going on in an FNL cosmology. The enhanced large-scale clustering is directly linked to a large squeeze limit for the three-point function. So one question that we wanted to answer is how this would generalize to other forms of non-Gaussianity. One calculation that you can try to do is just to ask if I have some general non-Gaussian initial PDF and I expand it in cumulants, how do the large-scale clustering power spectra depend on those cumulants? This can be calculated assuming a semi-analytic model for the halos, like an excursion set model. Let me just sort of summarize schematically what we get when we do this calculation. So we find that the matter halo power spectrum, contains a sum of non-Gaussian bias terms where each term is related to an appropriate squeeze limit of an endpoint cumulant. So it's the limit where you take the scale k to be the scale where you measure the halo power and integrate the remaining sides of the endpoint function over smaller scales. When we compute the halo-halo power spectrum, we find the same terms plus a new set of terms which are related to a different kind of squeeze limit. A different kind of squeeze limit where we have an endpoint function which is blowing up when some vector sum of the k's becomes small. So let me give a couple of examples to show that we do see this qualitative behavior in simulations. So here's an example where we get large-scale bias similar to what you see in an FNL cosmology, but from the four-point function. So here's a model, a non-Gaussian model, with a zero three-point function by the zeta to minus zeta symmetry, but a large four-point function in the limit where one of the k's in the quadrilateral goes to zero. This is just like the FNL model, but I add g and l times the cube of the Gaussian term. So its large-scale structure signatures are qualitatively similar to the FNL local model. Here's a plot from our simulation. This is a plot of the bias at scale k, a plot of one of our n-body simulations. And we can understand this effect as being due to this large squeezed four-point function. The mass, redshift, and scale dependence that we see in the simulations agrees pretty well with the general formula. Here's another interesting example. So I had mentioned there were these new terms where you have a four-point function which is getting large in a different type of squeeze limit, where the sum, the vector sum of 2k's becomes small. So our general formula predicts that this should generate enhanced clustering in the halo-halo power spectrum, but not the matter halo power spectrum. And that is indeed what we find in simulations. This type of model, so this is what's called stochastic bias. There's extra large scale power in halos. It's just not correlated to the underlying matter distribution. You can think of a four-point function which blows up in this limit as some sort of local variation in the locally measured value of sigma 8, which is independent of the long wavelength matter fluctuation, like if there was a second field modulating things. Okay. So in conclusion, the general picture for large-scale structure is the following. I think it's best to understand large-scale structure constraints as testing the assumption that the universe is statistically homogeneous on large scales. In other words, if we look at this part of the universe, do the statistics of the small-scale modes there look the same as in a far-separated part of the universe? Various squeeze limits, if you have so some non-Gaussian models violate this homogeneity property by blowing up in a squeeze limit, and that can be interpreted as a specific type of inhomogeneity. For example, a four-point function which blows up in this limit can be understood as a correlation between a long wavelength density mode and the locally observed small-scale skewness. You have three small scales correlating to a large scale. A four-point function which blows up in this limit can be understood as large-scale inhomogeneity in the small-scale power, but an inhomogeneity which is uncorrelated to the density. This leads to the so-called stochastic bias.
Why didn't you consider a three-point function blows up?
That's the FNL case. We just... Yeah, that's right. So we just wanted to understand how that generalized. What types of non-Gaussian models can you constrain or not constrain using large-scale structure? Finally, let me just kind of conclude and give some future outlook. This is kind of going to be when I put these slides together, I realized I was kind of making a laundry list of my projects and my papers in progress. This maybe is a reflection of the fact that this field is still very active. So primordial non-Gaussianity is an interesting probe of early universe physics because you have this multi-dimensional parameter space where different parameters are telling you different things about inflation, like whether interactions of the inflaton are important or whether multiple degrees of freedom are important. And you can map, there's an effective field theory formalism that lets you map interactions in the Lagrangian during inflation to observable signals. I think it's natural to ask, given this picture, whether we have a complete set of signals to look for. And I think we can't answer yes to this question because we're still finding new examples. One thing that I'm working on now is determining whether there are linear combinations of higher derivative operators, which are technically natural in the sense that they're radiatively stable. The answer appears to be yes, and this is related to generalizations of the Galilean symmetry in De Sitter space. Another interesting class of examples that has emerged recently in the theory literature is so-called quasi-single field or supersymmetric shapes, where you have a massless inflaton field that mixes with a field whose mass is of order Hubble. This happens naturally in supersymmetric models, and it generates some three and four-point signals that I didn't have time to talk about, but they're not highly correlated with things that have been looked for so far, and they could easily have been missed in the data analysis to date. So the CMB is kind of ideal from the data analysis perspective in that it's linear, so it takes endpoint functions of the initial conditions into endpoint functions of the CMB, and you get to measure all triangles or endpoint configurations and weight them by their expected signal. So you sort of get one estimator for each signal that you want to look for. The data analysis has not been easy. There have definitely been a lot of computational and algorithmic problems that have kept us busy. We think that we understand them. We have general solutions. And when we apply these methods to WMAP, we find, so far, consistency with Gaussian statistics. That said, there are some examples that have still not been analyzed. The theory is sort of ahead of the data analysis that I would like to look for in WMAP very soon. So Planck is going to be fantastic. We're going to put the Planck results out. Planck, at least the Planck three-point function will come out for sure in about 9 months. The only problem with the CMB is that in the post-Planck era, it's going to be difficult to improve further. So large-scale structure, I think, is the future of this field. You can potentially get statistical errors that are a lot better than the CMB, but this field is still in its infancy, and we're still understanding basic theoretical issues. So one thing that appears to be true is that getting an observable signal in large-scale structure requires that your non-Gaussian model blow up in some sort of squeeze limit. Another thing that seems to be true is that it's difficult. Large-scale structure can tell you with very high precision whether a squeeze limit of an endpoint function is blowing up, but it's hard to tell you which endpoint function or even which value of n. For example, a four-point function that blows up in the squeeze limit looks very similar observationally to a three-point function that blows up in the squeeze limit. There are some really fun basic unsolved problems here. One problem that I've been thinking about recently is how to simulate. One thing that's missing is a general prescription for just simulating initial conditions for an arbitrary interacting QFT. You'll notice for the n-body examples that I showed earlier that I used simple models where the curvature perturbation was a nonlinear function of one or more Gaussian fields. For a field theory example where you just have a set of operators that are turning on and generating non-Gaussianity, there's no real general prescription known for generating the initial conditions. So I'm working on, hope to finish soon, in collaboration with Adam Brown, a quantum mechanical algorithm for generating those initial conditions. This thing is really fun, but I didn't have time to talk about it today. Another thing that's fun to think about is whether, the slides that I showed made the assumption that the large-scale clustering power spectrum of halos or their tracers is the best way to constrain non-Gaussianity with large-scale structure. It's not clear whether that's really the only possibility. So if you want to think about this problem, here's a good way to start. What's really going on when we look at large-scale halo clustering is we're just looking at widely separated parts of the universe and asking, is the value of sigma 8, say, in those regions the same or not? Abundance of halos is sensitive to that. The abundance of halos in a region is very sensitive to its local sigma 8. And this makes large-scale clustering of halos a sensitive probe. But it's not the only possibility. You could ask, besides the number of halos in a region, what else could you measure that could tell the difference between different local values of sigma 8? So in conclusion, this is a very active area on theoretical and data analysis fronts. We're still quite far from our ultimate limits on constraining the unknown high-energy physics of inflation using low-energy observables like the CMB and large-scale structure. So the near future will bring many new theoretical results and observational constraints. Thanks. Yes, that's right. That's right.
Is that the sort of thing that is an ultimate limit, or can one foresee actually going, detecting primordial FNL that is below? I guess that's FNL of order one. That effective, is that roughly right?
So the largest. So it's true that any sort of second order effect will generate potentially a 3-point function. The largest second order effect arises because there's a cross correlation between large-scale ISW fluctuations and the gravitational lenses that alter the small-scale power spectrum of the CMB. So that's formally second order because you're sort of multiplying one lens by one primordial fluctuation. It's large because you get to multiply the lens by the growth function to get from the initial conditions of the late universe. So that effect, if you optimize a three-point estimator to look for that effect, you can see it in Planck in about six sigma. It'll show up in other three-point functions multiplied by a cross-correlation coefficient between its shape and the shape that you're looking for. For example, for the local shape, it's about a one sigma bias that has to be computed and subtracted. For the equilateral and orthogonal shapes, it's not particularly significant. So that is an example of something that you have to, a guaranteed three-point signal that you need to compute and subtract off. There's also some primordial stuff, which is, you know, heuristically at the level FNL of order one, which is small compared to the statistical errors in Planck. Well, if you had to go, so Planck is going to get to, in Planck, these are things that you can just try to compute and subtract off. And because the statistical error of, you know, and this is sort of a recipe for infinite complexity as you find more and more subleading possibilities and subtract them. Now in Planck, because the statistical error is delta FNL equals 5, then the things that we, unless we're missing something, the things that are significant compared to that error bar are things that we know how to compute and can subtract off. If you had to go down to FNL of order 1 using the CMB, then I think it would really be a big theoretical task to compute all those contributions. In practice, Planck will stop at delta FNL of around 5, and I think we're okay.
You said you wanted to use this quantum field ab initio quantum field theory calculation. But before you said that you were using this effective field theory, so isn't there a conflict between, I mean, if the effective theory is right, then what do you need this more detailed quantum field theory calculation?
Okay, so I'm just talking about a calculation in the effective theory. So if you have...
In the effective quantum theory.
It appears to be an unsolved problem. If you have some field theory defined on inflationary spacetime, it could be an effective theory. And it has some interactions so that you get some, you know, non-trivial endpoint functions at the end of inflation. That defines some probability distribution on the 3D field configurations at the end of inflation. And the problem is to draw a random sample from that distribution. So there's some work in the literature that tries to address this problem by computing.
Maybe I just haven't understood. Didn't you? I thought the claim was, when you say effective field theory, are you talking about an arbitrary choice of field content, or are you talking about, before you showed us something that you said was the effective field theory, which I understood just as two fields or one field or something like that. And the claim was that no matter what the underlying field content was, would reduce it to that single field. So you're talking about that. Is that right?
What are you saying? He's saying in that situation with one field, when you turn on that guy.
Some people have not.
You ask, what is the draw a random sample for the distribution of that field at the end of the equation.
So what is it that you showed us before? That were just guesses about what effective field theory would produce?
No. I mean, I don't think.
He just did a 3-point function, but now he wants a full statistical.
Oh, is that?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, for example, for one of the interacting models that I had before, like with the pi dot cubed interaction, the thing that we know how to compute is if we want to compute some endpoint correlation function, we can draw diagrams and compute it. But that's not the same thing as being able to draw a random field configuration, such that if you take a statistical ensemble, you reproduce those correlations.
So is there some hope of seeing difference? Does that mean looking at higher endpoint functions? I mean, what does it mean observation if you had that extra information?
For the FNL local case, both the 3 and 4-point functions have squeeze limits that blow up. that are relevant for n-body simulations. You want to make sure to get those right. So at minimum, I think if we're going to talk about simulating non-Gaussian initial conditions for an n-body simulation from some arbitrary interacting theory, we should definitely be getting the 3 and 4 point functions right without big problems like, say, a hidden... There are some algorithms that have been proposed that have hidden UV divergences. A higher cumulant looks small, looks like it's suppressed by high power of FNL, but it's proportional to a positive power of the K-max of the n-body simulation. So that's sort of a minimum benchmark, I think. What you would need to get the right answer in the FNL local case is just sampling a random field that has a physically correct 3-point function and 4-point function. There's currently no algorithm for doing that that doesn't run into no general algorithm that doesn't run into pathologies. So we have a general algorithm that really goes back to the physics, and you can make fun statements like I'll give you one cryptic statement. If you want to generate initial conditions that include all tree level contributions to the PDF with n vertices, then the computational cost of doing that is n cubed.
Which is much better than
Well, there's previous, currently there's no published algorithm for doing this.